much. It's a pleasure to have the opportunity to speak here, and it's especially nice to be back in the Perimeter Institute. I was visited here in 2004, before this building was built. I think it was under construction, so I had just visited briefly. So it's nice to see that it's under construction in a new phase of expansion. So congratulations to the Perimeter Institute on its ongoing success. So I'm going to try and explain to you how an alternative approach to non-perturbative studies of quantum field theory, it's going to be a somewhat idiosyncratic approach, or colloquium, in that I will take a rather unusual trajectory through possibly familiar subjects. So we will go from regulating quantum field theory to discussing physics in non-commutative spacetimes, and, well, perhaps a new microstructure for spacetime if one wants to be absolutely speculative at the end. So the outline is just that I'm going to go back and say a little bit about the divergence of quantum field theory, some parallels with statistical systems near a continuous phase transition. And then I will need to reformulate familiar concepts for non-perturbative studies. And this will bring us into matrix models, examples of fuzzy spaces, some simulations, and finally, emergent geometry. So I've written down, to begin with, the Lagrangian for quantum electrodynamics. It's familiar, I presume, to everyone here. This is the A mu is the gauge potential, and F mu nu is the field strength. When one studies it, the quantum field theory that is derived from this, there it turns out that one has to renormalize both the fields. So the field A mu is related to the original microscopic field A mu bare by some renormalization constant, of psi, the fermion field, by another renormalization constant, and the coupling constant, EB, is renormalized, is related to this. All of these renormalizations are, in fact, if one calculates them, divergent. So to define the theory at a microscopic level, one has to either use tricks, which is what is typically done in field theory textbooks. They will define it by analytic continuation of Feynman diagrams or various things like that. If one thinks about it carefully, you'll see that there is no real way of taking the original Lagrangian and working with that directly as a microscopic theory. And it shows up in the fact that these constants of renormalization are divergent. In a sense, this is just a change of variables in the space of parameters of the theory, in that I could have thought of each of these as coupling constants. I haven't described the mass. The mass renormalization is a little bit more complicated, and often in analytic regularizations is dealt with by a sleight of hand. So that's the structure of quantum field theory. To study the theory from a more fundamental point of view, the normal practice nowadays is to try and access stuff non-perturbatively, is to go to a Euclidean version of the theory. Euclideanization involves sending time to imaginary time. The field, which was I've just given the example of a Hermitian field, it should stay Hermitian. typically hermeticity properties of fields that are preserved. And the action then, which is the kinetic, the integral of the kinetic energy minus the potential energy, becomes a Euclidean integral. We get in minus I, so that e to the is goes in e to the minus se, and we have s, the original action, which was kinetic minus potential, becomes purely potential in the Euclidean setting, where we have gradient energies, and we get in the time one becomes an additional gradient energy. So once we have formulated the Euclidean field theory, you can see that this now is just, this looks like a Boltzmann weight, so we're looking like classical statistical mechanics. So one can, and thanks to the work of Ken Wilson, he explained the intimate connection between critical phenomena and statistical mechanics and quantum field theory, and Euclidean quantum field theory. The structure then in this setting is that in Wilson's formulation, the microscopic physics is governed by the neighborhood of some fixed point Hamiltonian, and one should approximate that, and the microscopic physics in renormalizable field theories is insensitive to how you parameterize or how you model that microscopic physics. So renormalizability is a statement of insensitivity to the microscopic structure. A theory is renormalizable if you can replace the underlying model by wildly different physical models, and which are in the same universality class and still retain the same macroscopic physics, that's the physics on scales much larger than the microstructure. For this, one needs to study, if one wants to start with a particular microscopic model, one should study the phase diagram of it and be in the neighborhood of a particular second order or continuous phase transition. So this is the contribution of Wilson. And his idea was based on block spinning. This is my effort to give you an idea of what block spinning might be. But let me just move on. In statistical mechanics, such phase transitions, continuous phase transitions, one a very classic one is the lambda point of helium-4, and some recent experimental studies in 2003 gave this very fine study of the peak, and quantum field theory, the Euclidean quantum field theory, describes the asymptotic region in here. So in fact, pretty much gives a good description of this region. The scale here, as you see, is in microkelvin and very small window around the critical transition. Superfluid helium is then described by a quantum field theory, which is a three-dimensional field theory of psi, complex. This is the wave function. And once one has understood that from Wilson's ideas that all one needs to do is capture the immediate vicinity of the critical point by Hamiltonian, which gives a foundation to Landau's ideas on critical phenomena. And starting from this Hamiltonian here, one can work out perturbatively in what's called the epsilon expansion, which works in close to four dimensions and analytically continues the loop expansion down to three dimensions, where epsilon is treated as a small parameter on a developed series. And the experimental situation is now in excellent agreement with seven loop calculations, but the experiments continue to improve, and seven loops is obviously not a way to go, even for statistical mechanical systems. One should do better. One needs some non-perturbative methods for studying field theories in general. And the intuition, once we are in the Euclidean setting, is to describe, to use statistical mechanics to do these things. So And I've just moved to another model, which is in the same universality class as the Hermitian scalar field. And this is the classical Ising model. So these are spins, SI, they take values plus or minus 1, and they are the Euclidean action is e to the minus beta times h, and this can be some potential, so it would, since SI squared is 1, the only potential here that's relevant is a linear field. So one then puts this Hamiltonian on the latticites. So scalar fields live on the latticites. Fermion fields will live on the latticites. Gauge fields will live on the links. And using this formulation, one can write down lattice gauge theories. I've just shown you what it looks like. You take L1, L0, L1, number of lattice points, write the theory down and study it as a function of the parameters of the theory. And this is an approximation. It has an intrinsic cutoff in the theory so that the divergences are automatically regulated. So the infinities of the theory are artificial. So one has to, in a full regularization of the theory, which is adequate for non-perturbative studies, one has to prescribe a microscopic physics. So prescribing a microscopic physics in the standard lattice approach is to prescribe a lattice Hamiltonian, which is in the same universality class as the model that's of interest to you. And the two-dimensionalizing model from various studies has been demonstrated to be in the universality class of a Hermitian scalar field, and more generally, an Ising model in 3 and 4 dimensions is in this universality class of a scalar field in those dimensions. So one could imagine taking as an approximation to the system, putting the model on a lattice, taking each of my taking some n now random configurations, sk, these are sets of configurations, and just estimating the partition function, which is given by this, z is equal to this sum over the configurations, and calculating observables. But this is actually a very wasteful thing to do. If you look at how you approximate the partition function for the two-dimensionalizing model, and I'm taking it just at criticality, so there's no free parameter. The partition function for the Ising model at criticality is an exact number. So one can look, how well am I approximating this as I take these random configurations, and the number of configurations to get 90% of the partition function, you see, for 2x2 lattice, I just need two configurations. So I need this fraction of configurations gives me 90%, and as I go to 5x5 lattice, I just need a very tiny fraction, and you can see that it's exponentially small, the fraction that I need, in fact, to simulate. I don't need all of the configurations. The probability is captured by a very small number of configurations. This is taken advantage of by trying to sample the configurations and develop the configurations that are necessary by putting an artificial dynamics on top of the thing. Since we're dealing with something that looks like a Boltzmann distribution, we can put an artificial Boltzmann dynamics on the system. It will relax to equilibrium, and once it's equilibrated, we will get configurations that are generated by this partition function. So the dynamics is at your disposal. There are many different formulations. The simplest one is the Metropolis algorithm, but there are alternative dynamics, hybrid Monte Carlo, any number of them that have been developed to deal with these quantities, and they are highly successful for gauge field for many field theories. And this is what is meant by lattice field theory is the study of field theories based on this formulation. However, this formulation has problems. Generically, it can't handle very well complex terms in the action functional. And this is obvious because if the action functional, the Euclidean action functional I'm referring to now, is complex, then it can't it can't be the equilibrium state of some Boltzmann distribution. It's not a Gibbs distribution. It's not a standard probability distribution. So it's going to have problems. One can attack it, but one has to go back to one loses the advantages of Monte Carlo sampling. One has to go back to just more primitive sampling. Fermions, when one deals with fermions in this setting, one's dealing with Pfaffians or determinants. These are very non-local because when we'll integrate out the fermions, fermions are realized as Grassmann variables. So one will have to integrate them out. When one puts fermion actions that are of interest on a lattice, one gets fermion doublings. There are various symmetries that are important, which one loses in the lattice. Chiral symmetry is difficult to implement. Supersymmetry on the lattice is very difficult to implement. As one can appreciate, supersymmetry is a space-time symmetry, so the lattice breaks space-time symmetry. So typically the symmetries that one is interested in supersymmetry, the most difficult aspect of it in practice is to find the set of parameters which would give the correct supersymmetric point. One has to find the values of the bare parameters in the lattice Hamiltonian that will work. And there are usually other problems, such as the fermion's determinant has no definite sign. It might even be complex. So even if it's real but has no definite sign, this is not something that can be accessed by a Gibbs distribution. One has cancellation of terms. So these are difficulties which are generic to simulations, in fact, with fermions. But additionally, an alternative formulation may shed different light on these things. So let me jump to to the second aspect of my talk. I'm going slower than I expected. The construction here that I'm going to work with and propose and has been proposed as an alternative formulation, an alternative regularization of field theories, is to say, well, let me change the underlying space to a non-commutative space. Let me take a finite volume phase space, quantize it, and quantizing finite volume phase space, you expect that it's going to be given by cells, and you expect a finite dimensional representation. If the area is A, then A over H bar should be the number of cells, and thus should be the approximate dimension of the representation of the algebra of observables. So the simplest example in this setting is the so-called fuzzy sphere. It was given the name fuzzy sphere by John Lador, who happens to be a Canadian, so I take no responsibility for the name. Some people dislike the name, but that's what it's called. So Brezen, Hoppe, and Mador treated the sphere as a phase space, and I'm just giving you a reference here to a book by Balachandran, Kuchlu, and Vaidya, where you can find many more details than I have a chance to describe here. So if you take and you quantize the sphere, the quantum version of the sphere is angular momentum. Sphere with fixed angular momentum is a classical sphere. When you quantize it, you get quantized angular momentum. Quantized angular momentum satisfies the algebra of SU2. And if I fix to an irreducible representation of representation J, then the quadratic Casimir is just the sum of these one, of the L's. So this is my discretized sphere a la Mathematica. This was my attempt to give a sphere which is going to come from the fuzzy sphere. It's meant to be rotationally invariant, but and it will be described by an algebra. So let me just review how you can see how you would recover the commutative sphere as angular momentum gets very large. So we're in the setting of nj, if I just normalize it so that my nj are divided by the square root of the Casimir. I switch from j, j to the label of the representation to n, the midsize of the matrix. So the sphere then is represented by, looks like a nice round sphere, except this is the unit matrix here. These are operators which don't commute. So there's an uncertainty principle, as you expect. But as n goes to infinity, this becomes zero, and you expect that these n, 1 in 2 and in 3 will commute. And this, of course, is what happens. But one is in a different representation. One is in the operator representation for these are, one has to switch back to functions to do that, to go back. The algebra of functions on the sphere is the algebra of SU2. So there's a change in the way that one is thinking about the things here, because one no longer has locality, so one should think of things in terms of global structures and from an algebraic point of view. And this is in along the lines of non-commutative geometry as developed by Alan Korn and others. So if I'm familiar objects on the sphere are the spherical harmonics, these go over to polarization tensors of nuclear physics, which are just matrices. The simplest example would be for n equals 2, the three coordinates go over to the Pauli matrices. So if one can, these are and these are essentially YL1, these are angular momentum 1, there are three of them, and the sigma A are my polarization tensors at L equals 1 in the 2x2 case. So this is more or less how you see things working. You can, of course, always, as in quantum mechanics, using different pictures of things, one can stay in the familiar position coordinate system, but now the product becomes a star product, a non-commutative product. So this is a useful technology for analyzing how things behave as n goes to infinity. And the product of two YLMs goes over to the product of two YLMs with a star product in the non-commutative setting. And there's a maximum angular momentum in the system because n is finite. So and as n goes to infinity, the star product goes back to the usual product. But, right? No matter how I dress up a star product and things like that, it's only suggestive of a geometry in the background. That's not a useful way of understanding a geometry. There is no geometry in mat in per se. The geometry has to come from somewhere else. This an interesting aspect of this side tail to this is goes back to the work of Mark Katz, who posed the question, can you hear the shape of a drum? And I picked a bowron to an Irish instrument just to give you a picture of what a drum might be like. The question is, if I give you the Laplacian, just only the Laplacian, can you hear the shape? Of course, Mark Katz knew that the answer was no, but he liked the question. Like the way that the question was formulated. It posed a nice mathematical question. And it is closely related to the asymptotics of heat kernels. So if I take e to the minus t times the Laplacian, you can see that the asymptotic expansion of the trace of this, I'm only using the eigenvalues, so if I use trace of e to the minus t times the Laplacian, it gives you the volume, it gives you the Euler character, it gives you various properties of it. So one can, under some certain circumstances, hear the shape of the drum. And in fact, if I give you my algebra functions and the Laplacian and a Hilbert space, this is what is almost what Kahn would call a spectral triple. Kahn would give you a Dirac operator, but the square of a Dirac operator is essentially a Laplacian. So if I give you a Laplacian in this setting, and I give you the Hilbert space structure of mat n, then you can hear the shape of it. That specifies the geometry. So that's the point of view on geometry in this setting, is one's got a nice round sphere represented by matrices. So all of the functions on it, any function that you care to represent, is represented by a matrix, and its Laplacian is just given by double commutators. And the eigenvectors of this Laplacian were the polarization tensors I described earlier. So if I want to make it an ellipsoidal geometry, well, I can put in different, I can break the symmetry by picking out different directions. We could do the same thing, mat n, for particular values of n. As I said, it doesn't capture any particular geometry, but I can equally write many geometries using the same things. The algebra functions, von Neumann said, all Hilbert spaces are essentially the same. So if I have a mat n as a Hilbert space, which is the way we're using it, I can represent CPn. It requires just taking essentially the same Laplacian, but where now I use the generators of SUn plus 1. A nice example in this setting is CP3. CP3 is six-dimensional space. It's realized as an orbit of SO6. One can realize it in many different ways, but it can be realized as an orbit of SU4, which is what gives it CP3, but it can equally be realized as an orbit of SO6. Or, in fact, as an orbit of SO5, in that any point on the orbit obtained by SO6, I can bring you back to the origin by SO5. So there's a one-to-one correspondence between the points of the orbits. The geometry is going to be specified by choosing which Laplacian. If I choose this nice SO6 invariant one, it's going to give me a nice round CP3, whereas if I choose a geometry that's deformed, that breaks the SO6 down to SO5 invariants, and I'll get deformed CP3s. The reason for choosing CP3 and focusing on it is because CP3 is an S2 bundle over S4. In other words, it's very closely related to S4. It's a twisted bundle, so it's not trivial, but over every point of S4, there's an S2 which twists around to give the to give CP3. S4 is not a phase space, so I couldn't approach it directly by quantizing it. It's almost a phase space, and in fact, CP3 is what makes it a phase. As a bundle, it's a phase space. If I want to put it that way, I can think of the S2 as parameterizing the complex structures. So if I take this deformed Laplacian, where I put in the parameter h in here, then the eigenvalues of this are, they break up SO6 eigenvalues into multiplets. And these ones here are the eigenvalues of the S4, and these ones here are the eigenvalues of this. This term Ci, which is the difference, essentially the difference of two quadratic Casimirs, is zero on representations that correspond to functions on S4. So it's a nice object, helps to project out, or in this case, make anything that has something to do with a function on S4 very massive. So that's imposing a Kaluza-Kleintein geometry on CP3, which is making the S2s shrink down to arbitrarily small scales. I should move on. One can do a little bit more. Since we're in the realm of analogs of lattice theory, we don't need to capture exact spaces. We can try and localize the functions that we want by killing off the terms that we don't want. So I can go down from S4, further down to an S3 by adding by picking a particular representation, insisting this is the back largest representation in the system, and I've decided to put a parameter in here and force anything that's not in this representation to be massive, to be or very high eigenvalues relative to the S4. This will give me an S3, so one can get a very large variety of spaces from this construction. One can even write down a disk, Fedeli, Vitale, and Zampini described what's called the fuzzy disk using this operator. This is just one creation and one annihilation operator on what is it, Laplacian. More generally, one can take a larger point of view and think of, well, what happens when I quantize Cn? Cn is a complex space. I can quantize it. This is just replacing essentially complex numbers by creation and annihilation operators. And one can project onto subspaces of these things. This gives a very large number of examples. One can extend these things to supersymmetric spaces. This has been done. I should have given a citation for that. One can move away from co-joint orbits, ones that have no symmetry whatsoever, by rather particular constructions. I've been describing what the algebra was and how the Laplacians might look on these things. Most interesting example, as I described, was the case of S4. So supposing I want to write down a Dirac operator on S4. Well, now I can write down the Dirac operator. First of all, S2. The Dirac operator on S2 is taking two copies of the spinner field, two matrices, fill them with Grassmann variables. Psi bar is gamma, is a psi dagger times gamma naught. Gamma naught is 1 here, so this is a psi dagger. The Dirac operator, dm, if I take S2, a convenient Dirac operator is sigma I times the commutator, Li plus 1. So the spectrum of this operator is exactly that of the commutative Dirac operator, except that it's cut off. The system here does not have fermion doubling. It's a rather nice system. Nothing additional was introduced. It preserves all the symmetries of the problem. And one can easily, construct further examples. S4 is an example we're studying more. So S4, I can take the Dirac operator, take the natural generators of SO6, spin 6 in this case, which is SU4, and these are the generators of spin 6. Take this operator, CI was the object that suppressed things that were associated with CP2 but were of CP3 but were not S4. So one can take this is a pragmatic Dirac operator on S4. Yang-Mills fields, one takes the commutator of LJ with the Yang-Mills with a gauge field. We're in non-holonomic coordinates, so we need to have an epsilon linear term and remove it. And there's a subscript gone astray here that B should be a K. But this one is in a setting where there are additional fields. And typically in this construction with Yang-Mills, there are additional fields associating it with some embedding of the system into some ambient, into this matrix space. So here, it's viewed as a three-dimensional space that it's embedded into, and what it amounts to is a scalar field, the so-called normal scalar field, looks like this if I expand it out. So it's just saying how dj is, I should have defined dj. Dj was L plus A. Deviating from in the normal direction. So we can write down a Yang-Mills action functional. So all is well. Good approximation we've got set up. We have now got the situation where we've lots of action functionals and we're in a good situation to start studying non-perturbative effects. What we now want to do is we want to study e to the minus s and integrate over matrices. So I want to go make a slight digression into the physics of matrix models. What's going on in matrix models? Well, the simplest model when one goes in, new physics emerges when one's describing matrices. I'm trying to do it in an integral over matrices as opposed to standard probability theory. One's in what mathematicians would call the realm of non-commutative probability theory. So we've a probability distribution P of phi, which is now e to the minus beta times the trace of phi squared. Phi squared is just a random matrix, and this is called the Gaussian random matrix model. And the partition function is just the integral over this. This is trivial. One can evaluate it exactly. However, if you look at it, the action here has an invariance under UN symmetry. If I change phi to U phi U dagger, then the action doesn't change. So this means that the distribution splits onto a uniform distribution on SUN on these flag manifolds, and a probability distribution for the eigenvalues, which are essentially just radii. Yeah? So we get mu of that of this one times a uniform distribution on this. This probability distribution converges as n goes to infinity to the Wigner semicircle distribution. In other words, if I want to take the expectation value of the trace of some operator, I can do integral over this, and I'll get the same answer in the Larging limit. So the generic features of random matrices are random matrix models are of a single random matrix are typically just characterized by the eigenvalue distribution of the random matrix. One of the key features is that the eigenvalues repel one another. This is familiar to people from second order perturbation theory in quantum mechanics. You see that you get 1 over EI minus EJ, which is telling you that eigenvalues of random of Hamiltonians like to repel one another. They don't like to be equal. So generic feature of matrix models, because each matrix model, the matrices are operators in some Hilbert space, and the eigenvalues repel. The eigenvalues tend to fall within domains, within finite domains, and the domain can have, it may not be connected, it can be distributed into many cuts. In the case of the Wigner distribution, the eigenvalues fall into this interval, and the eigenvalues grow typically with square root of n. And phase transitions occur in just pure random matrices when the cuts merge or separate. And these are very characteristic features which mess up the non-perturbative studies that we're doing here. So if I just look at a 5-4 model, for example, this, I'm just looking now at the pure potential. If I'm doing this on an ordinary lattice, nothing interesting happens here because all of the lattice points decouple. But now the system has some is one coherent entity. It has some matrix that represents it, which and all of the matrices is the elements interact with one another. So that's the non-locality I was referring to. So the model is still characterized by the eigenvalues of phi, the eigenvalues for c equals 0. This parameter being 0, we get back to the Wigner semicircular distribution. For ci being greater than 0, but bi less than 0, this is the standard Mexican hat potential. B is negative, c is positive, so you get this double well. the eigenvalues then fall into two disconnected regions, and they have two cuts. As the depth of the well is made shallower or deeper, there's a transition, and it occurs at b is equal to minus 2 square root of nc. Well, all this can be analyzed exactly, and this model was popular at one point as a random matrix theory of gravity in two dimensions with c less than zero. This involves some trickery. One really has to think of additional terms that are supporting this, that are higher order, that are irrelevant to the physics that's been concerned. So if I take this model, I can now describe my scalar field on a fuzzy sphere. So I've just written it with three arbitrary parameters. These would have been the three parameters that required renormalization in the commutative theory, A, B, and C. I've just given them labels. The LA are the generators of SU2. So the action of SN converges for n goes to infinity, right, to the action of a scalar field on the commutative sphere. One can make it very precise how it converges, but let me focus rather, because I've been going slower than I did. What happens if we now do the Monte Carlo simulation, which was take e to the minus s and study it non-perturbatively? We get a phase diagram. The model has, in fact, three phases. The commutative model, remember, was in the universality class of the Ising model. That has two phases. It has a disordered phase and a uniform ordered phase. Now the model has split into a disordered phase, a non-uniform ordered phase, and a uniform ordered phase. And the three meet at a triple point. This is a Lifshitz point. So and if one looks at it more carefully, this dashed line here is what I was telling you, the eigenvalues split into two segments. They merge. So as the eigenvalues are separating into the two wells, we're getting two cuts. We're getting the first transition is associated, at least up here, well away from the triple point. The transition is a one-cut, two-cut transition. So the well is becoming deep enough so the tunneling through the barrier is suppressed. And this one here is, there's a new phase. We get a non-uniform phase. And this is because the eigenvalues can take random plus and minus signs. The potential isn't sufficient to control the into a uniform phase. As we make the parameter B, we make the well deeper, we find that it has a uniform ordered phase. So the phase diagram, this is reference that we studied in 2006, repeated by some various people, and some recent attempts to try and explain the basic properties of it. The basic property is governed by the triple point. So the physics, if one can move the triple point out to infinity by adding some additional operators to the theory, then one will in fact recover the commutative theory. That's a work that's going on, numerical studies that are going on at the moment. Theoretically and conceptually, we believe we understand what's going on, that various effects can be controlled by adding some higher order operators and just moving the triple point, and then the physics of the commutative theory is just governed by this small region down here. Just some more thermodynamic quantities. One can look at the phase transition as one is going further up that one-cut, two-cut transition. One is becoming closer to the idealized matrix model, which is this dashed, specific heat looks like that. Let me go back to my Yang-Mills model and revisit it and study that particular example. So I'm going to do it as Yang-Mills on the two-sphere. But the difference between d DA, remember, was LA plus, was LJ plus, DJ is LJ plus A, capital AJ. So I can equally treat D's as my fundamental variables. And there's leave the background as something that's to be determined. The model generically looks like this, where I have some quartic and quadratic terms, let me suppress these terms. So there's an enhanced symmetry if I suppress the potential, because DJ goes to DJ plus adding something proportional to the trace, some trace is invariant. So we are left then with zero-dimensional Yang-Mills and a Myers term. The partition function for this system is that of beta G, B, and C. It's this integral. And I've pulled out all of the parameters of the model. I've charted them, absorbed them into beta, an energy, or an inverse temperature times an energy functional. This is my energy functional. The critical points of this energy functional are given by the commutator of this term here. This commutator, if you see that if I take a representation, which is a representation of SU2, any representation of SU2 is going to give me a critical point. So the representations of the Leander SU2 are the critical points, and the energy is just then minus 1/6. I can feed back in, if I take a representation, feed it back, the fact that it satisfies this commutator, I'm going to get this as my energy. It's obviously negative. So the minimum energy configuration is whatever maximizes the Casimir of the representation. And then one that maximizes the Casimir is to choose the largest dimensional representation. So it is easier. The ground state energy of the system is then minus n squared over 24. It goes to minus infinity as n goes to infinity, which is fine. And the configurations that set it, that minimize it, are these quasi-sphere configurations. So we see that the ground state of this system is, in fact, a quasi-sphere. If I look at a Dirac operator, in other words, I think of putting a fermion field on this background with this Dirac operator, which is this dynamical Dirac operator, including the gauge field, then on the ground state, forgetting fluctuations, I get this back, my nice round Dirac operator, and you can see that in the natural sense, the geometry is that of the fuzzy sphere. And there's a natural sense in non-commutative geometry, a rather precise sense, in which we have a spectral triple Allan Cohn, which prescribes the geometry. If we look at small fluctuations around this ground state, so the small fluctuations E of this energy functional around this quantity, they're described by the Yang-Mills these Yang-Mills A, including this scalar field, this normal scalar field. Just some variations on this model arose in the literature, including D0 brains wrapping on S3. This is Myers effect. But let me continue studying this model, just restricted to this very simple setting. Let's look at it non-perturbatively. What happens? We can now look at the expectation value of the action, beta times the energy, times the internal energy, S, I'm calling it. Beta is alpha to the fourth in the diagram here. And you see that here this is low temperature. So down here there's no ambiguity. It's a nice fuzzy sphere, the ground state. In fact, we're in the large n limit, so it's a nice commutative sphere, nice macroscopic commutative sphere. But as we change the temperature, the underlying geometry collapses. Something dramatic happens. There's a jump. There's a jump in the internal energy, a jump in the entropy. It jumps from 5/12 to 3/4, which is the high temperature phase. And you'll notice, once it jumped to the high temperature phase, it just stayed there. Nothing happened. So we have an exotic transition in this model. We look at the specific heat of the model. The specific heat and the high temperature phase as we approach this transition, it diverges. The high temperature phase, it looks like it's got one of these characteristic critical exponent divergences. In fact, by analyzing it a little bit using some theoretical techniques, one can estimate that there's a jump in the entropy, which is 1/3, indicating that there's some structural reorganization at a microscopic level. The specific heat, however, has this peculiar behavior in that it looks like it's got a continuous transition. It's got a critical exponent, which we estimate to be 1/2 for this alpha. And the critical point appears to be at this particular value of the number of beta C, which is alpha delta to the fourth. So if I just summarize that aspect of it, we've seen that in a very simple model of the two-sphere, it has a transition, undergoes a transition where the geometry just evaporates as we heat it, we heat the system up. We've got a nice, well-defined geometry at low temperatures, but as we heat it, the microscopic geometry just reorganizes in a dramatic fashion, and the sphere just collapses. The eigenvalues are no longer. So if we look at the eigenvalues, one can look at it in much more detail what's going on, because now we can look at the eigenvalues of a given matrix. So there's some distortion because there is a presence of a Yang-Mills field fluctuations on it, but this is in some finite size of x. But these are, as you can see, look roughly like the eigenvalues of L3. If I look at the commutator of L1 and L2, you can see they're peaked around this, again, look like L3. Now, if we look at it, the other side of the transition, we have to rescale quantities. So if we take a closer look at it, what does it look like? We saw that, in effect, the Myers theorem was completely irrelevant. So we should then go to a set of variables which allow us to set alpha tilde to be 0. We should make alpha tilde disappear from the problem and go to these variables, xa. And we see that in terms of these variables, everything in the high temperature phase is independent of alpha tilde. And if one looks at it more carefully, the high temperature phase fluctuations are around commuting matrices. So the zero-dimensional Yang-Mills looks like it's got commuting matrices, uniform distribution of eigenvalues within a ball, and nothing particularly interesting happening there. And from a non-commutative geometry point of view, there isn't an interesting geometry there. So we have a transition in which the high temperature phase, there's no geometry. The low temperature phase, we have a fuzzy sphere emerging. You can see the transition as one in terms of the eigenvalues. And this is plotted in the x variable. And following some suggestions of Bernstein, we find that the eigenvalue distribution for a given eigenvalue fits very well with a probability distribution inferred from the fact that it's a uniform ball. So you see, this is just a fit to give you an idea of how it works. So I'm summarizing, as the system cools, a fuzzy sphere emerges. If one thinking of the going through the transition from high temperature to low temperature, what happens is that the eigenvalues
are in some small ball at high temperatures, and as it comes down, a geometrical phase emerges, and the system expands to a much larger radius. I wanted to just give you a small feel for one other example where there's a transition in the geometry, in the underlying geometry. And this is a dramatically different setting. One prescribes the underlying microscopic physics to be a hexagonal tiling of a torus. This is something very like graphene in the end, hexagonal tiling. And what one wants to do is put in activities for the different possibilities of the weights along one direction. Remember, there are three directions that I can put in, A, B, or C, and I put in the activities here associated with those things. Partition function for this model is just given by sum over tilings and how many times A occurs, how many times B occur, how many times C occur. It's a very classical model in statistical mechanics. But it was found by Castellan, Fisher, and Temperley, and particularly the work of Castellan, demonstrated that it was essentially a lattice fermion system. And on a torus, the partition function is given by the sum over spin structures with the characteristic numbers and signs. As one approaches the transition, it has a phase transition. As one makes one of the I've chosen B and C to have fugacities given by beta and C to be fixed to be 1. In that case, the partition function has a transition as we increase the value of beta. The transition, it has no latent heat, but it again has this characteristic exponent alpha to the 1/2. This is known since the 60s. So we looked at this again just because of the transition having these particular properties to see was there a geometrical interpretation of it. So if one looks with some effort, one can look at the finite size corrections to this particular system. The finite size corrections to the partition function, removing the bulk partition function, one gets exactly the partition function for a Dirac fermion coupled to on a torus with modular parameter tau, and generically there are holonomies which are given by theta and phi, and both the theta and phi and tau are prescribed by the number of latticites n and m, how the ratio of those as it goes to infinity and the fugacities. What happens as one approaches the transition is that the modular parameter tau goes to tau zero and the continuum geometry collapses. So this is an example of another model which also has alpha equals 1/2. And again, in this particular example, there is no latent heat. There's another example which I didn't write in here, which is a six vertex model, which has essentially the same properties, but it does have a latent heat. Generic side. I'm just going to conclusions since I'm. So I have just attempted to give you some flavor for the fact that matrix models can provide a new arena for the regularization of field theories. I didn't discuss all the new physical effects that are various things like ultraviolet infrared mixing effects that happen in these models because we're in a non-commutative setting. The models are intrinsically non-local, but not as bad as fermion determinants. So it's if you're interested in models with fermions, you're not really losing by going to this setting over standard lattice approaches. Yang-Mills type models, we can see, blurred the distinction between background geometry and gauge fields. And in particular, I gave you an example of a three-matrix model where there's an underlying geometry undergoes phase transitions. And there at the end I gave some suggestion that such transitions belong to a new universality class of topological phase transitions, where it's the underlying geometry that's collapsing. And I've just repeated some of the things that I want to read out. I'll just thank you for your attention and leave you with that.
Sorry, I'd like to ask you, how does this compare to the usual lattice QCD approach? So, like, if you, in terms of numerical advantages or something, can you actually compute, blue ball masses, or can you, what can you do?
In principle, you can compute things like that, but one has to develop the technology and to understand the physics of those things. Yang-Mills fields turned out to be more surprising than we had expected, as you see. And I described only what was meant to be a U1 gauge field to capture other ones. One has to enrich the model. It hasn't been done yet. The one that has been most intensively studied so far is the scalar models, those being the simplest to understand. And when you start studying these things, you find that unless there is a theoretical background to fall back on, a jumble of data is very hard to interpret. So one needs the theoretical computations to guide one as well. So the subject, from a practical point of view, is in its infancy.
Another question? Are there hopes of explaining more complicated condensed matter systems with this approach?
Random matrices are used extensively in condensed matter. Again, it depends on the system that one is working. Condensed matter is a very particular subject in that one has to begin with the material that one is working with, and then one attempts to write some model on it. These are not models that have occurred naturally in statistical in condensed matter yet. Let me put it that way. Other models have been suggested but they are built more on just standard random matrix ideas. And the transitions that have been looked at in that setting are just one-cut, two-cut transitions. And transitions of that nature, just within the just pure random matrices. Here, we have put in additional structure. The additional structure is background matrices which prescribe the geometry. And those are a richer structure than standard random matrix models, because you're picking out additional background and structure. This is a more theoretical development than attempting to go into condensed matter.
Another question? Well, if not, let's thank the speaker.
Thank you.